federal charges in connection with a firearm in New Jersey and unrelated crimes, and subsequently incarcerated in a federal prison in New York. The respondent is befriended by Anthony Jarvolo, a state FBI informant and a fellow inmate posing as an organized crime figure. Knowing the respondent is getting tough treatment because of the rumor that he's a child murderer, Jarvolo offers him protection in exchange for the truth about what happened in his stepdaughter's murder, which Jarvolo has previously brought up on numerous occasions. The respondent consistently denying any involvement. The respondent tells Jarvolo that he had driven his stepdaughter to the desert via motorcycle, choked her, sexually assaulted her, and made her beg for her life before shooting her first attempt.
Okay. So he supposedly took her, buried her in a mesa. Based upon what? Based upon the facts, does the government have anything other than his statements as evidence? Okay. Yeah, I think the answer is no. Without his statements, you don't find the body and you don't find the other evidence and that sort of stuff. So that's one point worth making. How many of you have heard of Kenneth Starr? How many of you have heard of William Jefferson Clinton? Former Bill Clinton? The president? Okay. Well, Starr is the guy who wrote the report on that described Clinton's dealings with Monica Lewinsky. Good old Ken Starr, yes. He was the Solicitor General. The Solicitor General is the lawyer who argues the cases for the United States when those cases go before the United States Supreme Court. And many a Solicitor General has gone on to become a justice of the Supreme Court. Yeah. Thurgood Marshall, Elena Kagan, and I'm sure there are lots of others. So, and in fact, for many, many years, it was believed that that was the next step for a person who had been Solicitor General. And in fact, that was the case until we became such a polarized nation. So, what's the issue in, oh, one other point. Ironically, I shouldn't say ironically because that suggests a judgment on my part. People who are incarcerated for hurting children usually have to be taken out of general population in a prison because there is a code in prison. And that code is that we don't like people who hurt children. And part of the reason that that code exists is that many of the people who are incarcerated were abused themselves as children. And so that cycle continues even as people, even after people have been taken off of the street. And so the threat here was real, okay? So what's the issue?
The respondent's confession to FBI informant the product of coercion and that it was sought in exchange for protection in prison and that's a violation of the respondent's right to due process under the 14th Amendment.
Good. And if that's, and if it is, then what does that, what should happen?
In cases where coerced confession harmless error beyond reasonable doubt, the defendant is entitled to a new trial at which the said confession is admissible.
Okay, so, if you can prove that the confession was coerced as a result of government conduct, then that statement should be inadmissible under the due process clause. And we say that it's inadmissible because the statement isn't voluntary. And so when talking about statements and the due process clause, the test that is applied is this. Was the statement voluntary under the totality of the circumstances test? If the answer is no, then the statement should be excluded. So when you talk about due process and whether a statement is going to be admissible, the key word is was, or the key phrase is, was the statement voluntary? Yes?
I have a question. It seems to me that they were also arguing about this other point about this
error.
Almost.
Yeah, I'll get to that as well. And the point is well taken. But let's focus on what was the main point in this case, and that is, yesterday when we were talking, we talked about police or government conduct. I don't recall there being any government conduct in this, so why are we talking about the due process clause at all?
Would it not be government conduct in that this is FBI informant?
Okay, so what we have is an informant, yes?
So an actor who's acting on behalf.
How is that happening?
Okay.
All right. So, this person's job as a police informant, FBI informant, is to elicit information. Okay. So that's part of the answer to government action. But when we talk about the admissibility of the statement, we say that the statement must be involuntary. What evidence do we have that this statement was involuntary? Was there any evidence that it was involuntary?
Yes.
Yes. And what?
It would be that he didn't immediately give up the story, but only upon being prodded by the informant, he finally gave it up.
Okay, so again, when we talk about due process, the test is totality of the circumstances. So we're going to have to look for police or state action and the nature of that state action. In this case, the nature of that state action was that the government had a paid informant. It's not said anywhere in the case, but clearly this guy was suspected of doing something or having done something someplace else. There's no secret in prison. And so he had been targeted. And our informant was under a general order to get whatever good stuff you can get. And so he says to this guy, I'll protect you. And at that particular time, he needs protection. He is not safe in the general population. And so Bubba says, I'll take care of you. If. Excuse me. And so that's the force. That's the coercion. I may have to stop, go out, and come back in again. Thank you.
that leave anything out? This job is gonna kill me.
Do we have an obligation to save his life?
No. Nope. I spent the last 4 frickin' weeks reliving spring. So my allergies have been killing me. And we had a crap load of flowers in the building yesterday.
I blame you, Doc.
Well, I blame his friend. I used to walk the governor to his swearing-ins of new judges. That was my job. Walk with Mike up Beacon Hill to wherever we were doing the swearing-in. It was a great opportunity to get to know him. So, now, the other issue here, and it's going to be a long time before you see Supreme Court cases. The other issue here is how many judges vote to affirm, vote to affirm the decision of the Arizona court. And so we see it's Justice White. I'm sorry.
Beautiful.
Yeah, Justice White.
This was split all over the place.
Yeah, it's what we would call a plurality opinion. And so it's Marshall, Blackmun, Stevens. You have O'Connor and Rehnquist affirming in part, dissenting in part. And so it really does come down to counting the noses, and that's why, although you said 5-4 earlier, it's 5-4 on what? It may actually be 6-3 on some things. And so you have to look at it carefully. The harmless error doctrine that is being debated here is one where the chief, Rehnquist, wants the government to have the opportunity to use so-called involuntary statements in a limited way. When the government begins its case, the term that we use, or the terminology we use, is we're saying that the government is offering its case in chief. And so whatever affirmative evidence the government has of a person's guilt, that is what they are offering to the fact finder, to the jury. Then, once the government's case is completed, it will rest. And then the defendant will have an opportunity to offer evidence in support of his or her innocence. And frequently, defense witnesses will have little red wagons in back of them. Or the defendant might take the stand himself and say, I didn't do it. That statement clearly contradicts what he has said in prison. If you deem that the harmless error rule can't be applied to the statement, then the defendant can testify without ever worrying
about being impeached. What do I mean by impeached?
Taken out of impeachment, when you get the witness on the stand and you ask them questions, whichever side is asking the questions, they're going to answer usually in a way that's beneficial to that side. So what the other side is allowed to do is impeach the witness's credibility. What that means is to make the witness less believable to the jury. And you can do things as far as showing bias, showing that the witness has some sort of dislike or is invested in the outcome of the court proceeding, and that would mean that their testimony is going to be less reliable. It doesn't mean that their testimony is going to be thrown out, because it's up to the jury. It's up to the judge to decide if that testimony is going to be let in. It's up to the jury or the fact finder to decide how much weight you're going to give to that testimony. So if you call somebody as a character witness, and that person is the defendant's mother, well, maybe that's not somebody who the jury's going to lend a lot of weight to that test, to that credibility, because you're the teacher, obviously, and bias. But if that person is totally detached, doesn't seem to have a stake, then it's more difficult.
Thank you. You want to add anything?
You said your basic goal of cross-examining what you want to do. Anytime you've got a witness going against you, say your goal is to impeach their previous testimony. It basically nullifies their original statement.
And what would be the impeaching? What would be the impeaching evidence here?
Whoever's testifying for the government, he's, works for the government.
Yeah. Are you saying that then if you put the defendant on the stand and he says, hey, I never did it, then you can bring in the informant to basically impeach the defense? Just because then it wouldn't be brought into evidence based solely on him being the informant, it would be to rebut the testimony of the defense, basically saying,
thank you.
Sorry, threw me a curveball there.
It would be a prior inconsistent statement. That is, you said one thing once, and you said something else, you're saying something else now. So his confession would be inadmissible under the Due Process Clause in the government's case, in the government's case in chief. But if he were to take the stand, the government could ask him, didn't you say to this person in prison that you were responsible? Okay. The harmless error rule would allow the government to do that. If you don't have a harmless error rule, then that statement is gone forever. And so that's what the other discussion is about. Because the chief, Rehnquist, believes in truth and in the integrity of the process, he never wants a defendant to be able to take the stand and to deny conduct where there is evidence that he or she actually engaged in that conduct. So you will see that there's a harm. This error rule, when we talk about the illegal searches and seizures, and Rehnquist wants this extended to confessions. And the problem is that this is more than just a confession. this was a coerced confession. And so, generally speaking, we say that a statement that is involuntary should never be used for anything because it's simply not reliable. And if you introduce it into the proceedings, it distorts the fact-finding process. And so that's the dialogue that's going on between the justices. And I don't believe that Rehnquist succeeds. Rehnquist doesn't succeed here, but he at least makes the case. All right. So does everyone understand what the discussion about harmless error was here? This particular discussion won't be important to you until next year, when you have more criminal procedure, and you also have evidence. But it's worth talking a little bit about. Okay, so we've got a situation where, again, the Due Process Clause says that statements must be voluntary in order for them to be admissible. And the voluntary, we determine whether a statement is voluntary under the totality of the circumstances. And so you're looking for state action. And then you're also looking for some evidence of coercion. And the coercion in this case is the defendant reasonably believing that he is in risk of great bodily harm if he doesn't tell his little story, because he's not going to get the protection. I'm not sure how that applies to the wife, though, or girlfriend. How does that work with her?
If it was without the first confession, that was the basis of the motion. Is the motion to suppress? And they said that the second confession was
through
the first.
Okay. We've talked about this thing called the motion to suppress for sort of 3 days now. and now is as good a time as any to put it into context. Typically, as the parties are gearing up for a trial, in particular, a criminal trial, both the government and the defendant know what evidence is going to be available. And so, through their pretrial motions, they will try to get the court to make a ruling on something. And in a motion to suppress, again, we've got this sort of trial within a trial. So in a motion to suppress, you could have police officers called to the stand, the defendant could be called to the stand, simply to look at this narrow issue of whether some critical right is going to be diminished, violated, what have you, if it is heard by the jury. And so, the defendant files a motion to suppress in the trial court here. That motion is allowed. The government says, what up? Well, what about girlfriend over here? And so the defendant anticipates that and says, I would not have had the conversation with the wife or girlfriend if I hadn't been lured into talking earlier. And so it is argued that that second confession is the fruit of the poisonous tree. Okay? That without this initial illegality, you wouldn't have this subsequent activity. So that's why the wife or girlfriend or whatever she is, that's why the statement to her is problematic. Questions?
Wasn't that the second one more alleged because she didn't necessarily have the same degree of reliability? Then in one place it might have been a dissenting opinion that they said that she had, you know, opportunity to, or she had motivation to support her husband at the time, from the time we'd gone by, by elaborating, and she also ended up in the witness protection program or something.
Again, the point is well taken, but it's important to sort of understand the argument that you have repeated is the argument of the government. Well, hey, listen, he had the conversation with her. We don't appear to have the same level of coercion. What's the harm in allowing her to testify? And the defendant can rectify this by cross-examination, where he can go into the motives and everything of this witness to testify. And that would be a typical Rehnquist argument, that let the gladiators battle it out, the truth will emerge, the jury will figure out how much weight to give it, and, you know, we're all the better for it, but at least we haven't distorted the fact-finding process. The problem that the defense argues, what the defense argues, however, is that this information is so inflammatory. Keep in mind what's at stake. You have someone who is charged with killing a child, of molesting a child, and there's probably going to be a fair amount of sympathy by the jury for the decedent, and so they may be more inclined to ignore the instructions of a judge. And so, as a matter of policy, one could argue that we're better off just not ever allowing that conversation to take place. Now, Justice Rehnquist and his buddies will disagree with that, but that was the decision of the court in this case. Okay? Any other questions about this case? So we have one more, and then we will take a 10-minute break, and then you get to go into your own private little hell. Okay. What's with what? Who's up for this case? You know what? Well, I won't say anything, but who's up for this case? And I would hope that it would be someone of a male species. Because my recollection is all the volunteers have been from the other gender. Except for, I'm sorry, I apologize, yes. We're not doing any gender bending here, so. I apologize. I still need a volunteer. I'll be glad when this phase of the class is over. You know, step up. You're all on the. I'm calling everybody probably on Monday, so that way we'll get this out of the way. Step right up. You might actually get through Monday's class by speaking now. Okay, there we have a brave person.
The defendant, Hamdi, arrived in Afghanistan in July or August of 2001. He was captured, handed over to U.S. military, where he was detained and interrogated in Afghanistan and transferred to Guantanamo Bay in January 2002. In April 2002, after landing in the American system, he was transferred to a naval brig in Norfolk, Virginia, and then transferred to Charleston, South Carolina. In June 2002, Tommy's father filed a writ of habeas corpus.
Okay.
What is the basis for the habeas corpus complaint? I think somebody's about ready to bail you out. Yes, what's the basis for the habeas complaint?
Prevented his son from having any access to counsel or notice of charges against him.
Okay. So, this is a situation where we are looking at another sort of definition of what would be due process. And so due process, one of the things that due process encompasses is the notion that you have a right to know why you are being held, and you have a right to contest that. And so by this person being held in the brig and as an enemy combatant, he can't do that. Again, as a bit of background, what is the nationality of the person being held here? He's a U.S. citizen.
Born in Louisiana.
Born in Louisiana. Natural. You birthers got to go away. I'm sorry about that. I don't know where that came from. He's an American citizen. He's born here in America. That fact is significant because at the time that this case is working its way through the system, the notion of an enemy combatant if you are a foreigner, it's accepted that the due process clause does not apply to you. But because he is a U.S. citizen on U.S. soil, there is the argument is being made that he's entitled to all the rights and privileges of any American citizen, including the right to file a writ of habeas corpus. I have seldom seen a case where someone else files a writ for you or for the accused. And because the argument frequently will be that the person who is alleging that rights have been violated must allege that their own rights have been violated. Not your friends, not your mamas, not your papa, but your own rights. And so he's filing this matter on behalf of the son who cannot get to anyone to do the filing. The military simply isn't going to recognize this. Now, this case is in Virginia, and that is significant because this federal court in Virginia is known as the Rocket Docket. That means stuff happens real fast here. You can get a trial, you can get to the Court of Appeals and everybody else in a relatively short period of time. Look at the window here. This guy is taken into custody in 02, and by 04, this matter is before the United States Supreme Court. Trust me. It doesn't happen often. It doesn't happen. But it can happen in Virginia because of the Rocket Docket. The judges just move stuff along very quickly. And that's what they're known for.
And as you go through civil procedure, you will see that there are times when a litigant can pick which federal court that they're going to use. You can pick the federal court where you live, or you can pick the federal court where one of the parties is, maybe held, detained, or whatever. And since the son is being detained in Virginia, this is a perfect setting for going to the Virginia Federal District Court, which has the reputation for doing things in a speedy way. Okay, so we've got the rocket docket. It gets to the court. The word certiorari has come up a lot in the cases that we've read, and have not taken the time to define that concept. But since you've seen it so much, I'm sure that someone has gone online to see what certiorari means. Well, what does it mean?
What?
I'm sorry?
You have an exact definition?
If it makes sense, go for it.
To be informed of a higher court in a case in which it has discretion to hear an appeal, ask the lower court to send up a certified copy of the record of the case so that the higher court can determine whether any irregularities have occurred in the proceeding.
In English, what does that mean?
Basically, you have to see if there was any errors that were made from the other court that's sending it to the higher court.
Not quite. Anyone else want to take a shot? Yes, ma'am, in the back.
It says a decision by the Supreme Court to hear an appeal from the lower court.
Uh-huh. So how do these things go together?
Basically, it's just a decision by the Supreme Court to hear an appeal from the lower court because an error has occurred.
You're missing the key element here. Key element is discretion. When we talk about, there are some cases that the Supreme Court must hear. The cases that it doesn't have to hear get to the court on a writ of certiorari, where the court decides that it wishes to get involved in this matter to clarify things. So it's the court's discretion. The court literally votes on whether or not they are going to hear this a matter. And before coming to class, I was trying to do some things, and I can't remember whether it's a minimum of 3 justices or 4 justices. But I know it's not more than 4. At least 4 justices have to vote in favor of granting the writ of cert in order for that to take place. So in all of these cases, there was more than one justice who thought that this matter should be dealt with by the entire court. Yes?
So what are the cases that the Supreme Court must take?
That's correct.
Would they be?
Ask your con law teacher. Ask your con law teacher. I don't remember. There are some cases that they, you know, cases involving the Congress, certain federal questions, the court must take them. But typically, these cases aren't the types of cases that the court must hear. That's part of what made the decision in Bush versus Gore so extraordinary, because the U.S. Supreme Court did not have to take that case. And most of us pundits were stunned that they did, that they reached down and took the case before the Florida Supreme Court could decide, you know, the validity of that election. So, you know, but that's the power that the court has. It's the highest court in the land, and sometimes if someone asks,
even though most folks say you should stay away from it, it gets to the court. But anyway, that's our story. We've had this around for a while and haven't talked about it. So, all right, how many justices vote in favor of Mr. Hamdi having a right to a hearing? Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. I have four. No, I have four dissenting opinions, so five. Have a dissenting.
I'm gonna try again. I mean, one of the good things about this experience is that we won't be nose counting often in this course, but because we're dealing with cases from the United States Supreme Court, it's important to know how many justices voted in favor of the plaintiff or the petitioner's motion.
60.
It's a 6-3 decision. Now, they don't. One of the things that you will find is that there is something called a judgment. That is what you do with the case, how the case is resolved, versus why the case is resolved in a particular way. There are 6 justices who agree that the person is entitled to a writ of habeas corpus and is entitled to a hearing. They just simply don't agree on why. And that's why part of the reason why you said 4 people initially. Because you have 4 folks signing on to the fact that the law is valid, but even though the law is valid, this American citizen is still entitled to a hearing. The other justices, the other 2 justices say the law is invalid, and so the defendant isn't, or the petitioner is entitled to a hearing. So the 6 don't agree in terms of a rationale, they agree on an outcome. And so that's another way that the court does business. You have 2 justices who are prepared to invalidate this law. And so that's why they say, yeah, give me a hearing. It's not until 3 or 4 years later that this same right is extended to non-U.S. citizens. And we here in Boston are fortunate because many of those lawyers who took those cases are right one that's about 10 miles from here in Tiverton. Many of the big law firms were troubled by the Patriot Act and decided to fight it. Okay, why don't we take a break, then we'll do the exam. 10 minutes, be back here.